Good to see so many of you back in the afternoon, and the session right after lunch sometimes is not the easiest session to teach, I know. I didn't eat, and so I don't think I'll have a problem, but some of you will. I did have a cup of coffee that sometimes helps a bit, and I might tell you that I do suffer from a medical condition known as ACDS. That stands for Acute Caffeine Deficiency Syndrome. And there is no cure for this, but the symptoms are fairly easy to treat. I have tried to develop a theory on this, and my theory is that if you suffer from ACDS and you're tired and you sleep, all you're doing is masking the symptoms. You're not getting at the real cause, the caffeine deficiency. And that can be dangerous because when you wake up, you won't be tired anymore. And then you might have a caffeine deficiency and not know it. It was undiagnosed and untreated, and thought of writing an article for a medical journal on this. I mean, they published dumber stuff than that, so why not? But I've decided I was going to refine that theory a little bit. And my refinement on it would be developing the concept of cup hour deficits to make this more scientific. My theory is that for every hour past midnight that you stay up at the computer working, you need a cup of coffee in the morning to get you back to normal. And so, in other words, you can measure this scientifically. If you stay up till 3 a.m. working at your computer and you only have one cup of coffee in the morning, you're operating on a two-cup-hour deficit. And, well, you can see where this is going to go and probably absolutely nowhere, exactly where it should. But I've also had something else that I thought I would maybe contribute to development of afternoon speakers. And some of you might have seen these ads on television about this device that you can get keeps you from having an accident while you're driving. You put it behind your ear, and if you nod like that to sleep, it gives you a little jolt and wakes you up. Well, I thought about buying a whole bunch of these to pass out to my students, and anyway, it's just one concept that probably will go nowhere, but and that's probably wise. What I'd like to do this afternoon for the first hour is take you on a journey across the world. And that's why we're calling this a tale of five cities. We've more than doubled what Charles Dickens had said. And we're going to be looking at various places that we could cite as origins for our American law. Five cities we're going to be visiting are going to be Jerusalem, Athens, Rome, London, and Bethlehem. You'll notice Mecca is not one of them. But let's begin by looking to a source of law, going back to Jerusalem itself. John Adams, our second president, probably the greatest scholar ever to sit in the White House. John Adams' library was one of the largest in North America at the time, and what is so interesting about his library is that not only are the volumes there, but he carries on a running dialogue with the people he's reading and comments where he agrees or probably more often disagrees with what they have to say, and sometimes in very, very strong terms, like calling somebody fool or things like that. But on one occasion, he's reading one of the French philosophers who's talking about all the glories of Greece and all the contributions that Greece has made to Western civilization. And Adams writes in the margin, "Much as I admire the Greeks, I think the Hebrews have done more to civilize the world. Moses did all of their philosophers." And I think that's a very accurate statement. When we look to the role the Hebrews played in actually developing and originating, or perhaps it might be more accurate to say, receiving from God and conveying to us, basic biblical principles of law and government. I'm going to try to set out several principles that we see in Hebrew thought here that influence government. And the first of these is that the one God is the author of law. Now, if we say that God is the author of law, we're not going to be disagreeing a great deal with a lot of other societies. In fact, in a book that I have with the publisher, it's going to be five volumes, and it's coming out, well, they say it's going to be out 1 October. I'll be surprised if they can do it that fast. But at any rate, One of the things I've done is I've gone through the legal systems of ancient societies, going all the way from the Egyptians, the Mesopotamians, the Persians, the people of India, China, the old Polynesians, the Inca, the Maya, the Aztec, and others. One thing that is common with all of them is a belief that their laws come to them from a higher source than man. They may call them God or the gods or the Tao, but the idea that there is a higher law that somehow has been communicated to man by a superhuman source that is the basis for law and to which human law needs to conform. Now, the Hebrews hold that belief the same as do just about every other people in the history of the world, but there's something unique, and that is Hebrew monotheism, that is, one God. Now, there is an argument to be made as to whether ancient societies start monotheistic and degenerate into polytheism, or whether they start polytheistic and evolve into monotheism, and I think there's a few arguments to be made on both sides. I think the evidence is that other societies, nearly all of them, you can point to ancient Egypt and many others where there is strong evidence that originally they were monotheistic and that they degenerated after that. But the Hebrews, primarily because God called them out specially with first Abraham and then gave them the law through Moses, the Hebrews were able to preserve and even develop this concept of monotheism or one God in a way that most other societies did not. Now, why does that matter for law? Well, think about it. If law has a superhuman source, then how can law be consistent without monotheism? If you are, let's say, a Viking, and you believe in the old Viking gods, well, maybe Odin has given one set of laws, and Loki has given another set of laws, and Thor has given still another, and a feminist like Freya maybe has given another set of laws. They're not going to be consistent. What do you do then when you compare those to Marduk and his laws of the Babylonians, or Zeus of the Greeks, or Jupiter of the Romans, or Ishtar and others of the Egyptians? You will have all of these competing systems of law. With Hebrew monotheism, you have one, and one basis for law, and therefore a law that is going to be consistent. Not only in Hebrew thought is law consistent, but law has a distinctive ethical dimension. In most pagan societies, they will believe that the gods have given laws, but we obey those laws because the gods have given them and we don't want to offend them and we want to have their good favor and harvest time and things like this. But with monotheism of the Hebrews, it is sometimes referred to as ethical monotheism. God gives laws not just because he wants to set some rules of order. He gives laws because they are right. And there is a clear ethical dimension to Hebrew legal thought that we don't find in other systems of law. In fact, one concept that you see throughout the ancient world is sacrifice. And sacrifice seems to be fairly consistent with most ancient societies. Even human sacrifice is very, very widespread. But there is a difference between sacrifice in Hebrew thought and Christian thought and sacrifice in every other ancient system that I've ever seen. The difference is this. Pagans will sacrifice, whether it's a part of their crops or their livestock or their money or their firstborn child, whoever it is, they will sacrifice because they want to gain the God's favor or avoid the God's anger. Sacrifice in Jewish and Christian thought carries a very different dimension to it. We sacrifice not simply because we want to avoid God's wrath or gain his pleasure. We sacrifice to satisfy God's justice, a concept that, from what I can tell, is unique to Judaism and Christianity. So the relationship, then, that we see here between law and unity and righteousness is a major contribution of the Hebrew legal system. Another major contribution is the idea of human nature being corrupt. Now, Jews will not have a developed doctrine of original sin in the same way Christians do. I think you can develop that out of the Old Testament as well as the New. But in most Jewish thought today, they will say man sins. They will not say man has original sin. That's more of a Christian interpretation. But they will recognize the flawed qualities of human nature. And they will recognize this. The Old Testament is very clear when Isaiah says, all our righteousness is as filthy rags. When David says, behold, I was shapen in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me. And we can go through many Old Testament as well as New Testament passages that demonstrate a concept of sin. And as we've seen already, this concept of sin leads to the view, number one, that we need government to restrain order, and number two, that we need to restrain government because, as Lord Acton would say in the 1800s, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And so here's something else we see then in Hebrew thought, and that is a concept of decentralized government. You recall that after the Jews, they shouldn't be called the Jews yet at this time, but after the Hebrews leave Egypt, we find that they are governed with 12 tribes. It's kind of like a confederacy, you might say. They have one central judge who heads the whole group together and serves as the warlord that leads them, but we find that each of these tribes pretty well governs itself and is pretty much autonomous. And that has advantages. It's a way of preserving freedom from centralized power. It also has disadvantages. One of the disadvantages is that you don't have a lot of cooperation in wars with foreign nations. When we see various cases, like when the Midianites are attacking one particular tribe, that tribe will organize to defend, and the idea of getting help from the other tribes, well, maybe, but you can't really rely upon it. And so the tribes were kind of on their own when they were beset with warfare and foreign powers. We read about Israel at this time, that at this time there was no king in Israel. Each man did what was right in his own eyes. And that sounds like a very nice system, but that's not the way it is meant. It's meant to say that there was a lot of chaos, there was a lot of instability, and a lot of apostasy during this time as well. The time of the judges had both some good points and some bad points. So decentralized government. Now we see this decentralized government developing further as we look to the Council of Elders when Moses calls upon 70 elders that continue to serve as kind of a cabinet to advise him and perhaps as rulers of the people as well. And many believe the 70 elders that Moses calls at this time will become ultimately the Sanhedrin that rules at a later time. And you recall the Sanhedrin, that there are three Sanhedrins that rule over different parts of Israel. Each has 23 judges in them. These are judges and priests together. And when they meet together as one, they're called the Great Sanhedrin. And there you have the 69 plus two that are the chief priests that lead, meaning 71, and that's where some say 70, some say 71, but we can see that concept coming from way back in the book of Exodus. We can see also where Moses is asked by his father-in-law, what are you doing? Remember, we read that he is governing the people, and that as he governs them, he's serving as a judge, and as his father-in-law, Jethro, the Midianite, sees him there doing this, and Jethro asks him, well, what are you doing there? Why are you up at 3 every morning to judge these cases, and you don't get to bed till 11 o'clock at night? This is awfully strange, and it doesn't seem to be working very well. Why are you doing this? And he said, well, the people come to me with judgments, And so I judge them. And he says, and probably one of the most classic statements of irony and understatement in Scripture, Jethro says, the thing that thou doest is not good. You will wear away. And so he suggests to Moses that he needs to call and train judges. And anyway, as he says, when Moses, I'll just read the text here. Hearken now unto my voice. This is Exodus 18. I will give thee counsel, and God shall be with thee. Be thou for the people to Godward, that thou mayest bring the causes to God, and thou shalt teach them. In other words, teach the people in the laws. Thou shalt teach them ordinances and laws, and shalt show them the way wherein they must walk and the work they must do. He's to be educating the people in the law. But further, moreover, thou shalt bring out of all the people able men, such as fear God, men who are graduates of ABA accredited law school. No, he doesn't say that. Men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands, and rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. In other words, we've got the justice of the peace courts here over every 10 families, and we've got the municipal courts over every 50. We've got the district courts every 100, over the court of appeals over every 1,000. And Moses is going to be the Supreme Court. Let them judge the people at all seasons, and it shall be that every great matter they shall bring unto thee, but every small matter they shall judge. So shall it be easier for thyself, and they shall bear the burden with thee. Well, you can see the idea of decentralized government again here. And Moses apparently follows Jethro's advice, a Midianite contribution to Hebrew law, but one that is entirely consistent with the will of God. As we move on, we see that the day is going to come when Israel is going to demand a king. And it's interesting why they want a king. Let's take a look at this as we see it here in Deuteronomy chapter 17. 17 and verse 14, if you'd like to follow along. When thou art come into the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, and shall possess it, and shall dwell therein, and shall say, I will set a king over me, like as all the nations that are around me, thou shalt in any wise set him king over thee, whom the Lord thy God shall choose. One from among thy brethren shalt thou send king over thee. Thou mayest not set a stranger over thee, which is not thy brother. First of all, people are going to demand a king, and several hundred years later they, in fact, do so, and do so for exactly the reason that Moses predicts, the most stupid reason for wanting a king that anybody could imagine, so we can be like the nations around us. Those nations around them are tyrannies, and they are miserable, but we want to be like them. And the first thing about this king that is to be set over them is to be that they are to be one from among the brethren. In other words, the king is to be one of the people. Thou mayest not set a king over thee who is not thy brother. Now, this sounds like Jewish nationalism here, but there's something more to it than this. The idea here is that in these nations surrounding Israel, the kings are regarded as gods. They are worshipped as gods. State worship and emperor worship are the order of the day. But not in Israel. In Israel, the king is to be one of the people. And it's a little more difficult to think of the king as a god if he also happens to be your second cousin. Further, we're told that he shall not multiply horses to himself. And I have obeyed that command quite faithfully for the last several years. We have only one horse. And we did have more earlier, but now I'm the only one at home that rides anymore. So we're down to one horse at this time. What multiplying really is here, who knows? But there is a reason for not multiplying horses. One of them is he does not want them to be dependent on Egypt. And that's the common source at that time of cavalry horses particularly. And they are not to be engaged in aggressive warfare against the nations around them. Defensive warfare, yes. Aggressive warfare, now that the conquest is complete, no. Goes on to say, he shall not multiply wives to himself, that his heart turn not away, neither shall he greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. Well, first of all, as far as multiplying wives to himself, We see what happens in the days of Solomon, when Solomon had, 600 wives and 300 porcupines or concubines or whatever they were. I may not have the numbers wrong there, but sometimes these are to cement alliances that he has established with foreign nations. And you might imagine a Egyptian princess who is about to marry Solomon. You know, I don't know if I can marry you, Solomon, because I'd have to live in Jerusalem. And, you know, we worship Ishtar, and I don't think you'd let me worship Ishtar. Oh, no problem, honey. We'll just set up a little temple for you right in Jerusalem, and you can worship Ishtar, and I'll worship the true God, and no problem at all. And then as time goes on, well, honey, where shall we go to church today, your church or mine? And Solomon actually begins worshiping in these pagan temples with his pagan wives. And so we see how this causes his heart to go astray from God. And further, we're told he's not to multiply to himself greatly silver and gold. He's not to enrich himself unduly. And exactly how much we would say is too much is not quite decided here. But this may refer to excess taxation. It may refer to enriching himself personally, or maybe both. And then we're told it shall be when he sitteth upon the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write him a copy of this law out of the book of that which is before the priests, the Levites. And it shall be with him, and he shall read therein all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, to keep all the words of this law and these statutes, to do them, that his heart be not lifted up above his brethren, and that he turn not aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left, to the end that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children, in the midst of Israel. He is to write out the law of God when he begins his reign. He's to do so in the presence of the priests to make sure he gets it right. He is to read from it daily, and he's to follow it carefully. And what God is saying through Moses here is that even though having a king is probably not God's perfect will for Israel, Israel can still be a blessed nation if they follow these principles of a limited monarchy. And we see a clearly limited monarchy here, and you see a separation of powers. We see a separation of powers between church and state. We see the kings coming out of the tribe of Judah, the priests coming out of the tribe of Levi. We see, first of all, that in the civil side of government, we have the executive power of the king. We have the Sanhedrin and the Congregation of Israel, which, when you see that term, it talks about somebody addressing the congregation of Israel. Well, by this time, Israel has a population of well over 4 million, and even George Whitefield would not be able to address a crowd that size. And so we're talking here about the representatives in something like a House of Representatives or House of Commons, the tribal elders and tribal judges and so on that gather as sort of the lower house of the legislature, the upper house being the Sanhedrin. So we see a separation of powers even here. And then there's a concept here of equality before the law. That doesn't mean that everybody is to have equal wealth or equal popularity or equal respect. What it means is that all are equal before the law. And we're told that you are not to have one judgment for the rich and another for the poor. You are not to heed the rich specially, or heed the poor, or countenance a poor man in his judgment. That was less of a problem. The poor were less likely to pay bribes, not so much because they were less depraved, but because they didn't have money to pay bribes with. But the idea of equality before the law is another clear Hebrew concept of law. So as we look to these concepts then, these are some of the contributions that today we derive from Jerusalem. Well, let's move on now and let's head to the next stop on our tour, and that is going to be Athens. And despite liberals' love of Athens and love of Greece as a whole, and it seems to me many times that they are very selective in what things about Israel or what things about Greece that they love, in Athens, at the best of times in Athens, at least 35% of the people were slaves. And yet, today's modern intellectuals so often are unfettered in their praise of Greece, you look to Sparta, and there the percentage that were slaves was in some cases as high as 80%, and slavery was considered a much worse condition there in every way than even it had been in America. In fact, you look to the way some of the Greeks tried to justify slavery. Plato, who modern liberal intellectuals love, Plato said that slavery is necessary for freedom. Now, how did he figure that out? Well, the idea is that if you were a free man, and freedom in Athens really extended only to free adult males and nobody else, but if you were a free adult male, you had so many civic responsibilities, jury duty, and juries would consist of a couple thousand people sometimes, and it was very cumbersome and unworkable. Or you might be in charge of various departments in the Athens city government at various times. You would have so much responsibility that you wouldn't be able to attend to your business or your household or your agricultural interests. And so you had to have slaves that could do that for you. So slavery was essential to freedom, as he put it. Aristotle argued that slavery was just part of the natural order of things. Aristotle said that there are only a few people that are really capable of freedom, and these are free adult males, that the power of reason is something they have, and that's what they need to exercise freedom. The power of reason, he said, is absent in women, it is undeveloped in children, and it is inoperative in slaves, and so they would be as miserable being free as free adult males would be miserable being slaves. And Aristotle, of course, is a free adult male, and that's how he justifies the condition. And yet modern intellectuals who could never say a good word about the American South will just be lavish in their praise about Greece. Russell Kirk makes the observation that the founding fathers looked to Greece as an example of what didn't work. They looked to most of the Greek city-states and saw that they were nothing but tyrannies. The few that were democracies, like Athens, were unstable and unwieldy, and freedom there existed only for a few, and freedom there, when you'd have a period of freedom, it would last only a very short time. And so there really isn't much to admire about Greece. But there are a few things that we can learn about Greece. And there are a few concepts they give us. One of those concepts is the idea of the forms. Now, if you ever had a first-year philosophy course, you've read Plato and see what Plato calls the ideal or the forms. And the professor will explain that, saying the physical things we see around us here are not ultimate reality in Plato's view. In Plato's view, ultimate reality consists of these ideals, or these forms. And usually what a professor will do then is he'll look around and the first thing he sees is a chair, and so he says, for example, you take a chair there. Now that chair, that's not the ultimate reality. The ultimate reality is the form that we know as chairness. And somehow, maybe off between the planets Jupiter and Saturn, there is a hazy area that we call form land, and there are shadowy chairs and pianos and who knows what all else floating around there. And these have some kind of mystic communion to things here on Earth. And so that is where ultimate reality lies in his view. Now, Aristotle had a somewhat different view. Aristotle didn't deny the existence of forms, but Aristotle said that ultimate reality consists down here in the things around us, and forms are real to the extent that they conform to this ultimate reality, which is that which is around us here. Now, I'm not sure myself that Plato ever really meant this to be the way it's commonly taken, that he's meant it to be that there is this form land up there with this mystic communion. I would suggest that he really meant something a little bit different. And let me try to illustrate what I mean here. I thought I had a pen. Here we go. But What do you see there? What is that? A triangle. Okay, now let's talk about what a triangle is. What are the qualities that make up a triangle? Three sides. What do we have to know about those three sides? They're connected, of course. Okay, if we're talking about certain types of triangles at least, the angles all have to be equal. The sides have to be equal length. What is that called? Is that an isosceles? Equilateral triangle, exactly. Okay, good. Now, what I'm showing you here, is this a triangle? Well, are the sides equal? Not too bad for a guy that just barely got through 10th grade geometry and flunked kindergarten art, but the sides don't quite touch. They're not straight lines. The angles are not too different from each other, but not precisely equal. We would say this is an equilateral triangle to the extent that it corresponds with the ideal. Not necessarily that there's this ideal floating around in space somewhere, but the ideal does exist. Now, you look to Aristotle, and as I say, he's going to emphasize more what actually works, what corresponds to function. Let me show you something here that I had brought and left at the house, and I thank Becky and Dan for bringing it over here. But for those of you who have an interest in martial arts, as I know of a few of you do, you might be interested in this. This is a little martial arts tool that I picked up. It's a pretty wicked tool in a lot of ways. And, you know, you've got a little protection for the knuckles. It'd actually work a lot better if these knuckles were covered as well. But at any rate, you can hold on to it much better than you could hold on to a knife at this angle. You could press with more force with it. You could stab. You could slash. You could do many things with it like this. But the question I would ask you about this, is this a knife? Depends on whether you're asking Plato or Aristotle. Plato would look at that and he'd say, no, that's not a knife. A knife is one blade and a handle and a point in the end. That's a knife. That's not a knife at all. That doesn't conform to the form or ideal of knife. Aristotle might look at it and he'd say, well, it's a funny looking knife, but it would do the things that a knife is supposed to do, cut and stab and slash. So, I guess it's a knife of sorts. Anyway, so that illustrates a little bit the difference in their outlook toward reality. Now, Aristotle contributes some things there too in regard to what we saw earlier, the concept of truth. Truth to him is not necessarily consistent, corresponding to the ideals or forms. Truth, as he defines it, is that which corresponds with reality. And then we'd have to get a definition of reality, and that there we come to more. But concept of justice, then, rendering to each person what is due, and as we saw last night, to understand what is due to each person, we need to understand the truth. Did he or didn't he commit the crime? Now, what are they doing here? They're giving us a basis for an understanding of law and justice. When Plato speaks about the forms, the ideals, he's giving us a basis for a belief in a higher law or a natural law. Now, Cicero, the Roman, is going to develop this a lot more than Plato did, but the idea that a form here, an object here, must conform to the higher reality leads to the idea that a law that is passed by Congress has to conform to the higher law, that is, God's law, in order to be valid. Likewise, Aristotle gives us a solid, objective concept of justice, rendering to each man what is due, based on a solid and objective concept of truth, that which corresponds to reality. So we do see some contributions in their thought. I don't know how many of you might remember the Sophocles play Antigone. You might remember there that it's a play where you have a civil war taking place within a city-state, and Antigone is a beautiful and noble woman, but she has two brothers who have fought on opposite sides in the war. King Creon is the winner in the war, and he issues a decree. The decree is that Oh, by the way, both of the brothers who fought on opposite sides, both are killed in the war. But the decree, then, is that all those who fought on my side will be buried with full military honors, but those that fought on the other side are going to lie out there and be food for the vultures. Well, Antigone goes out on the field and buries her fallen brother in defiance of the command. She is brought before King Creon, and Creon really offers her an excuse to get out of the thing. Well, did you know about the rule? She said, no, I didn't. That's not what she says at all. Of course I knew about it. Everybody knew about it. But I defied it. And she defied it, she said, because there is a higher law, a law that neither kings nor gods can change. Their view of God is a much lower view than our view of God would be. And that law provides that I have a duty to bury my fallen brother, regardless of what the consequences might be. Again, the idea of a higher law that even justifies civil disobedience is something that you can find there in some Greek thought. Well, let's move on from there to Rome. And the framers found more to admire about Rome than they ever found to admire about Greece. Fair to say that the Romans were never as philosophically oriented as the Greeks were, and probably were not as culturally minded as the Greeks, but they were practical, and they had a genius for organization. And they achieved something that the Greeks never achieved, and that was a stable system of law and government that for much of the time had a fair measure of freedom attached to it, and that survived over a long period of time. We sometimes date the beginning of the Roman Empire as somewhere around 753 B.C., and of course you know the story about what happened there, that you have the man Romulus who establishes Rome. Now it's interesting to get the history on this. How many of you seen the movie Troy? A number of you saw it? You remember right at the end of the movie, there's several people who are leaving the city and escaping, and I believe it was Paris who asks one of them his name, and he says, but do you remember what? Aeneas. Now you might say that Aeneas represents the Greek and Roman cyclical view of history and time, but he represents Troy's revenge on Greece. Aeneas travels throughout the ancient world and stops at Carthage on the North African coast, and there he has a love affair with Dido, a Carthaginian queen or goddess or somewhere in between. It's not quite clear. But then he believes that the gods are calling him up into Italy. And so he leaves, and that explains Carthage's hostility to Rome. Hell hath no fury like a goddess spurned. And goes up to northern Italy. There he has some children and a grandchild of his, two grandchildren, Romulus and Remus. And these two brothers are raised by a wolf. And then they decide together to found a city. And as they're building their city walls and so on, Remus makes fun of Romulus' city, so Romulus naturally kills him. That explains a lot of history. If Remus had killed Romulus, we'd be talking about the Roman Empire instead of the Roman Empire. But Romulus is the founder of Rome. Somewhere around 753 BC, and whether there's any truth to the story of Romulus or not, we don't know, but that appears to be about the time it was founded. The Western Roman Empire continues until about 475 AD. The Eastern Roman Empire continues about 1,000 years later until 1453 with the fall of Constantinople to the Turks. Here is stability. And the founding fathers admire this stability. It's something the Romans were able to achieve that the Greeks never were able to achieve. But when we see the founding fathers and their admiration for Rome, the ones in Rome that they admire were not the emperors, the Caesars, and so on. The ones they admire were the old republicans. Brutus Now, there are two Brutuses. Junius Brutus I is way back there in 500 BC. It is he who throws out the Tarquin kings and designs the Roman Constitution and founds the Roman Republic. And then there is a man who probably was a descendant of his, claimed to be at least, and that is the next Junius Brutus, the one who joined in the assassination of Caesar, and who, unlike some of the others, did so with very noble republican motives in mind. And the framers admire them both. But they also admire others. They admire Cato, particularly Cato the Younger. They admire Virgil, as Virgil, the poet who drafts the Aeneid, which is Rome's answer to the Iliad and the Odyssey of Homer, and in which we see the old Roman virtues. Sometimes it's said that the gods of Rome reflect the Roman character, that the Greek gods lived, the Roman gods worked, and that's something about the difference in the character of the two countries. Russell Kirk even makes the observation that the reason that Greek failed, the failure of Greek politics, is traced to the failure of Greek religion. That the Greek gods didn't inspire people to live good lives, and therefore they failed in developing the kind of civic character that the Greeks would need for effective republican government. The Roman gods, particularly in the early years, had that stern old Roman character that the Greek gods lacked. And that sternness, that character, is something that did characterize Rome. You know, they were all business. But one thing about Rome, you know that they would do what they would say they were going to do. For example, if a nation decided to ally itself with Rome, if they were under attack, they would have no doubt that the Roman legions would come to their rescue. That was Rome's policy. If we make an alliance to somebody, we owe them our full military protection, however much it costs. And they would defend territories that it may not have been in their short-term interest to defend. There were many things about Rome that were admirable, but Rome, too, ultimately fell. And it's hard to figure out why Rome fell, and some of the reasons that are given really don't stand up very well. Some say that it was Christianity that caused Rome to fall, but if that's the case, then why is it that the Eastern Roman Empire, which was far more distinctively Christian than the West, survived the Western Empire for more than 1,000 years? I think one of the things that made Rome fall, although again this is hard to explain other than the fact that Christianity displaced Greek culture, one of the things that caused Rome's fall was its embrace of Greek culture. There's an old saying that Rome conquered Greece militarily, but Greece conquered Rome culturally. And that is often true throughout history, that conquerors win militarily, but the ones that conquered ultimately win the victory in culture. We're going to see that later as well. But Rome embraced Greek culture. When we look to Greek culture, it had gone a long way toward Oriental despotism. Just as the Persian kings originally started out as limited monarchs and then came to really like the idea that they could be worshipped as gods, and by the time of Xerxes, they were just as despotic and just as divine in their own view as any of the Oriental monarchs were, Alexander begins as the first among equals with his officers, and Persians were amazed at how much Alexander would allow his general staff to criticize him freely in staff meetings. But after Alexander began to conquer to the east, he began to see all the precious raiment that these Persian and Indian kings and rajahs wore. He loved all of that. He thought that being considered a god was wonderful, and if he was never persuaded that he was a god, he was certainly persuaded that it was in his interest that people think he was a god. And he began requiring his officers to prostrate themselves before him in a way that the Persian kings and the Indian kings before them had done. Rome, or rather Greece, embraced the culture of the East. And Rome then embraces the culture of Greece. And in so doing, I consider this to be one of the main things that leads to the fall of Rome, the beginning of the rise of the empire, as we see the Roman generals eventually considering themselves empires, which was utterly prohibited in the days of the Roman Republic, and Caesar at first, and then Augustus Caesar, who really founds the dynasty afterward. And Kirk, I think, is wrong on one thing. Kirk says that the Romans were far too much a Western people to ever take emperor worship seriously, but if you read through Suetonius and the 12 Caesars, it certainly sounds like they took it very seriously indeed. And we can look to so many of these, like Caligula, insane emperor who names his horse a consul. We can go on to see Nero, and Nero considered himself to be a Greek god, a devout lover of everything Greek and Greek culture, and became a strong persecutor of Christians. He killed his first wife, and then he kicked to death his lover, who was pregnant with his child. He was a bisexual, with probably more homosexual than hetero. And finally, the army decided they had enough of Nero, and they managed to pursue him out of town, and as they surrounded him, oh, by the way, I have to say, too, he was extremely fat, but he loved the Greek Olympic Games. And guess what? He always won. Is that surprising? But the Roman legions catch up with him, and as he is ready to die, he stabs himself to death just as they get to him, and his last words were, "What an artist dies in me." One concept of divinity that they had in the Western Roman Empire is that you really couldn't be fully a god until the Senate had voted to make you a god. Now, how a mortal Senate could make you immortal was not quite clear in their thought. But the ability to remain stable is something that Rome provided. And it's interesting that even in the days of the chicanery that is going on at the emperor's level, of kings poisoning each other and lovers being involved in all kinds of palace intrigue, during all of that, at the local level, it seems that the Roman concepts of law and order and their system of justice with their courts and the like continues to function effectively, even despite all of the incompetence and instability at the top. So there were some things that they did admire about Rome, and as a thinker, undoubtedly, they thought more highly of Marcus Tullius Cicero than any other, and Cicero, the way he develops the concept of natural law, defines it as being right reason, which he says is rooted in God himself, and it appears that Cicero was a believer in one God, although not necessarily the Christian God. But we're going to move from Rome now, and we're going to go to another place. And each of these cities that I name here is presented here as a symbol. Next place that I'm going to give is London. And London is an ancient city going back thousands of years. But I mention London simply because it symbolizes the system of common law that we develop here in the West. And when you look to the people who populate the British Isles at this time, you divide it into periods. First of all, we have the Celts, and the Celts have their own system of law, and they govern until about 50 AD when the Romans take over. And their system of law, they have an intellectual class that is known as the Druids. And there is a lot of conflicting information about the Druids. Seems like some of the Greeks really identified with the Celtic people in many ways. They kind of shared some of the same laid-back philosophical emphasis. The Romans, on the other hand, kind of identified with the Germans, businesslike, well-organized, and so on. And anyway, when we read the Roman writers, they are very critical of the Druids, say they practice human sacrifice and all sorts of things like this. If you read some of the Greek philosophers of the time, they suggested they were really more like the Jewish priestly caste, or possibly even like the Magi caste of the Babylonians and Persians, believers in one God and faithful to the light they had been given until Christianity comes and gives them further light. But in this Druid class, it's divided into various types of people. You have, first of all, the medics, those who had a pretty well-developed system of medicine. You have the historians. You have the bards that compose the songs and carry on the culture that way. You have the advisors to the kings. The cabinet is mostly druids at this time. But then you have what's called the Brehons. Now, the Druid Brehons were the Druid lawyers, the Celtic lawyers. And in order to become a Brehon lawyer, you had to study law for 14 years. And they didn't commit law to writing. They believed that when you commit things to writing, that retards the memory. And so this was oral tradition, but they would learn it well. It makes it a lot more difficult for your client to question what you're saying. Well, if you've been to law school for 14 years, well, then don't question me. You have no basis for it. But at any rate, the Brehon lawyers then become their system, and they do have a system that is quite decentralized, is practiced locally with each tribe. In fact, there really is very little central government until several centuries after the time of Christ, at least. But all of this is the way they are governed until the Romans come in and force Roman law upon them from about 50 AD until about 450 AD, when the Roman legions suddenly withdraw because Rome is now overextended and they need them back in Italy. And when this happens, the influence of Roman law seems to come to a stop and they revert back to their Celtic institutions. This would be the time then when we see people like King Arthur and so on, if there was a King Arthur, and I think there probably was, although a lot of the Arthurian legends are incorporated from other medieval sagas and epics and the like, but I think that there was a man named Arthur. But at any rate, then along comes a man named Patrick. Now, Patrick is one of the most fascinating figures of history, and of course, we just just celebrated St. Patrick's Day just a couple of weeks ago, and we think of him as the patron saint of Ireland, even though he was not Irish, and probably wasn't what you'd call traditional Catholic. Patrick was born on the west coast of England, in the northern parts, possibly as far north as Scotland. We believe that his mother was a Celtic lady. His father may have been a Roman, and his name at that time would have been Patricius, the Roman ending. But he writes that he was raised in a Christian home, but that he had left Christianity and gone a long way from it when he was captured by pirates and taken to Ireland as a slave. And he served about 7 years in Ireland as a slave. And during this time, he says, even though he didn't like being a slave, he loved the Irish people. And apparently his master had a lot of trust in him because he let him take care of flocks of sheep long, long distances from where the manor was. And he managed to make his escape. Got to the coast and managed to board passage on a ship back to England, and there managed to make his way back home again. Oh, by the way, he says that not long after he came to Ireland, which was entirely pagan, he remembered Christianity and remembered God, and he came back to his Christian faith very quickly at that time, he says. But he says when he got home, he had a vision in which the people of Ireland were saying to him, "Come, holy boy, and walk among us once again." And he interpreted that to be a divine call that he was to go back to Ireland as a missionary. He first of all went to get some theological training, and then he did go back to Ireland. Now, it's interesting what he did. First thing when he arrived in Ireland is he went back to his former master and paid him the price of a slave. Now, not many people would feel the obligation to pay once they'd escaped, but he did. And it did a lot to establish his credibility as a man of honor. And for the rest of his life, he preached the gospel in Ireland, and did so with considerable success, so that by the time he died, Ireland was mostly Christian. But another major contribution was a Christian concept of law, one thing that Patrick carried with him wherever he traveled, were copies of a little scroll called the Law of Moses, and he would give these to the Brehon lawyers and to the chieftains. And then, not too long before he died, the High King of Ireland called upon him to draft a written legal code for Ireland, and he established a commission with Patrick as the head of the commission, and the commission then consisted of three Christian bishops, three chieftains, and three Brehon lawyers. In other words, the Druid lawyers. And Patrick, in his introduction to the Sentius Mór, which is a code that governed Ireland until about the 1600s, he says that we decided we would start with the old Brehon law, and that we would follow the Brehon law except where it was inconsistent with Scripture. And where it was inconsistent, we would change it to be consistent with Scripture. But he says, for the most part, with a few exceptions, the Brehon law was consistent with Scripture. In other words, it was the old law of nature as they still understood it. And he says, and this is the Sentius Mór, or the greater law, that governed Ireland and governed the Celtic portions of the island of England as well. Well, we think about those people, but there's another group of people at this time that we need to think about too here, and that is what we call the Germanic people. You have the Celtic people, who were mostly to the east. In fact, France, as we know France today, was originally called Gaul, and at that time, France was Celtic. In fact, there is a town there on the Mediterranean called Galatia, and this was a Celtic people. Paul writes his letter to the Galatians to a Celtic people. And there are some who think that Joseph of Arimathea, being a tin merchant, perhaps had interests in England, which was the main source of tin at the time, and that he may have, in fact, planted the gospel in England. And at first I thought that was ridiculous, but the more I began to read, the more I thought, well, there is some basis for this. And I won't say I'm convinced, but I think it is possible that Christianity in the British Isles began with Joseph of Arimathea. But you have these other people that are a little bit to the east of them in Germany and areas around Germany, people that we call the Germans, or the Germanic people, sometimes called the Teutonic people. And they were divided into many tribes. But in South Germany, many of these tribes, like the Lombards and the Visigoths and others, pretty much take upon themselves German ways. I mean, Roman ways. They adopt the Visigothic code, which is pretty much like the Roman code of law. The Franks adopt the Salic code that Charlemagne governs under, and it was fairly consistent with Roman law and its organization and the elements within it. There were some aspects of Germanic law as well. But in the areas to the north, the areas of the Angles and the Saxons, there you see more of the old individualistic Teutonic common law governing instead. And this is partly the result of a great battle that took place just over 2,000 years ago in September of 9 A.D. There was a German chieftain by the name of, well, the Latin name for him was Arminius. The Germans called him Hermann. Hermann the Liberator, he is known as. If you go up to New Ulm, Minnesota sometime, you will see on a hilltop there a huge statue that looks like a Viking, but it's actually a German chieftain, Hermann the Liberator. And Hermann united the northern tribes of Germany, and at a great battle in 9 A.D., the Battle of Teutoburg Forest, he annihilated three Roman legions and drove the remnants of them back across the Rhine. The result of this is that from that time forward, the areas of Germany north and east of the Rhine, and Scandinavia as well, were free from Roman influence. And so they continue with their old common law, that is a local council that for the Scandinavians, they called it the Ting. For the Germans, they called it the Witan or Witan. Consisted of all free males in the community. And they served both as a town council that governed people, but also as a jury that tried cases. They would elect every 3 years a law speaker, and he was the judge who would preside over their proceedings, and every year they would have to have one grand council. It was a requirement at this council that the law speaker recite from memory one-third of the law, so that in the course of his three-year term, he will have recited from memory the entire law, and that way the people listen, including those that are among the people of this time who have been law speakers when it was their turn in the past. And so law, unlike with the Celts, where it is just that private possession of the Brahman priests, or like the Romans, where it was only for those who were well-trained in it, for the Germanic people, it is the common possession of everybody. And it was a very individualized system of law, trial by jury with strong emphasis on individual rights and the like. Well, anyway, when the Romans leave England, or Britain as it's called then, and the Celtic people there consider themselves being oppressed by the Scots and by the Irish and others, what I was always taught in history is that they invited the Anglo-Saxons, these northern tribes of Germany who followed the old Saxon law, invited them to come to the British Isles and help defend them against the Scots and the Picts. There is reason to question now whether they were actually invited or whether they came on their own, but they did come, and they did manage to subdue the Scots and the Picts and make the area we now know as England a peaceful area. But then they said something like, you know, you've really got a beautiful island here. We like it. In fact, we're staying. In fact, we're taking over, and if you want to stay, you can be our vassals. And that's essentially what happens, and that's how the Anglo-Saxons come to England, and that's why Britain is then called Angleland or England, and they develop a very decentralized system of government there. In fact, in their system of government, they are divided in exactly the same way that the Hebrews were divided, into local communities or towns of 10 people, into broader communities of every 50 families, then every 100 families, and then every 1,000 families is considered a shire, a area of government. And it doesn't change every time a few more babies are born or a few people die. They don't move the borders, but when we say 1,000 people, that's how it begins, and it remains. These remain the divisions as they continue for hundreds of years thereafter. But the man who is really the executive officer over each shire, and that shire is governed by a witan, but the man who is the governing officer over them is called the Earl, or as the Scandinavians call him, the Jarl. And he has an assistant. His executive officer, who serves process and performs arrest and really is the muscle behind him, and he's called the reeve. So the shire has a reeve. And you say that together enough times, shire, reeve, and what do you get? Sheriff. That's where the word sheriff comes from. And many of these concepts come from old Anglo-Saxon England. And then we find King Alfred the Great. Alfred the Great, living in the late 800s AD, develops the first legal code for England. Alfred was a very strong Christian man, and it was during his reign and shortly before that the Vikings began raiding on the northern coast, and he manages to fight them to a standstill, and then he enters into a treaty with Guthorm, the Viking king, that they can settle there. They can have this area in northern England, which will be called the Danelaw, and they can govern that according to Viking law, and everything south will be governed by Anglo-Saxon law. The two types were not very different. And he said, oh yes, one thing I also forgot to mention here. Guthorm, you and all your people have to become Christians as a condition of this. And they at least profess to become Christians. They go through baptism, and for all we know, this Christianity is real. But then in 890 AD, Alfred develops this legal code for England. And he begins it. Well, let me just read you the way it is worded at the very beginning. And this comes from an 1830 translation. If I were to read this in the Anglo-Saxon, I couldn't read it and you couldn't understand it. If you know what it is, and what I have here is from a source by the English government called Ancient Law, and it's a real treasure, but on this side it's in the Anglo-Saxon, on this side it's in 1800s English, and when you know what this is, you can pick out a word here and there, but if you think Chaucer is hard to read, this is several hundred years before Chaucer. But here's the way Alfred's Code of Laws begins. The Lord spake these words unto Moses, and thus said, I am the Lord thy God. I led thee out of the land of the Egyptians and of their bondage. Love thou not other strange gods above me. Utter thou not my name idly. Remember that thou hallow the rest day. Honor thy father and thy mother. Slay thou not. Commit thou not adultery. Steal thou not. Say thou not false witness, covet thou not thy neighbor's goods unjustly, make thou not to thyself golden or silver gods. Why the graven image commandment is placed at the end, we don't know. One tradition is that Alfred had sent a delegation to the Middle East to bring the commandments back in Syriac or Aramaic, but at any rate, that doesn't fully explain the order, but throughout that book of laws, we see numerous citations from both the Old Testament and the New Testament. It is a thoroughly Christianized source of law. Well, we can go on and talk about other influences on the English common law, the Jewish commercial law that comes in. One of the things at this time is that the Pope has prohibited lending money at interest. And that pretty well dries up the money market. And so, if you want to borrow money, you need to go to the Jewish sector. Because the Jews interpreted the law differently. As they interpreted it, the prohibitions against taking money at interest applied to loaning money to a poor person or a widow or a sojourner from another land. But if it's just an arm's length business transaction with a businessman, no problem with charging interest there. And so the Jews came to dominate the money market in England and throughout much of Europe. And as a result, the Jewish commercial code, which was developed by Rabbi Moses ben Maimon, or as they call him, Maimonides, one of the most brilliant Renaissance men, this pretty much becomes the commercial code of England, and it's based upon the Jewish Torah and, frankly, on the Talmud as well. But we see this development of the law of England, the Anglo-Saxon common law. Are we supposed to quit at 2:45? I see. Let me just summarize real quickly then. We could develop that. In fact, we already talked about the Norman invasion, the Magna Carta, the Puritan Parliament, the English Bill of Rights, the Glorious Revolution, the American Declaration of Independence. But this will give you a little bit of the background with Jerusalem, with Athens, with Rome, with London. But wait a minute, I said five cities. The fifth city is Bethlehem. And some years ago, if you had asked me, I would have told you that there is no difference between a Jewish view of law and a Christian view of law. And there are many similarities. The latter, of course, is built on the former. But there are some differences. For one thing, the concept of grace through faith, that virtue is something that is attainable by all through Jesus Christ. The equality that we have in Jesus Christ. The idea of the two kingdoms, that our ultimate citizenship is in heaven, but that God has established these two kingdoms, church and state, and he has given authority to both. The concept of original sin or total depravity. And one more concept. A concept that many of us call human good. Some of them, like Calvin, has called it common grace. Others, like Luther, have called it natural grace. Others just call it civil righteousness. To me, that's a concept that we have missed today, and we've forgotten about it, and it really makes it a lot more difficult to explain the gospel to people. As you're trying to convict people of sin, and you say people are totally depraved, you say that there is nothing righteous in us, well, I just can't believe that. My next-door neighbor's not a Christian, but he's as nice a guy as you ever find, and I just got back from the military, and I've served with a lot of brave heroes over there. They weren't all Christians, but they were good people. I can't agree that we're all sinners. Well, the problem is we are omitting the concept of human good or common grace. We're failing to understand that what we mean when we say that all have sinned and come short of the glory of God is that we are stained, that in my flesh dwells no good thing, as Paul puts it, and that nothing that we are or can do is pleasing to God. But that doesn't mean that we can't be law-abiding people. It doesn't mean we can't be good neighbors, helpful to others. It doesn't mean we can't be good parents. One of the best examples of common grace, of course, we look to the passage where Paul says in Romans 2:14 to 15 about the law of God written on men's hearts, but the passage where Jesus is talking about the giving of the Holy Spirit, and he says to these people, now what man among you, if his son asks him for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks him for a fish, will give him a serpent? Sorry, I don't have any fish, son, but here's this rattlesnake you can chew on for a while if you want to. Better make sure he's dead first. Well, what is he saying? He's telling people here, you being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children. In other words, people who are sinners still know how to be good parents, good husbands and wives, good neighbors, good citizens, good soldiers, good workers. The idea of common grace, that it pervades us, and it's what makes it possible for civil society to stay together, but that in no way can it satisfy God's demands of righteousness or be pleasing to God. But this understanding of common grace or human good, I think, is one more contribution of Christianity to an understanding of the proper view of law. Well, we are supposed to take questions at this time, or do we take a break first? Okay.